today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Oh, hey, Jim, what are you doing out here?
I'm just enjoying a cigarette between episodes, Patrick.
Me too. Nothing like a between episode cigarette.
How do you think this Rush episode will do?
Signals? Really? We're going to get like tons. Three hateful calls.
All right, we've been talking about Rush all week.
Yeah, we have. It's been fun.
We're going to keep talking about Rush.
Mm-hmm.
And before we do that, or one aspect I want to get into the band here before we go into the next album,
okay,
is this. Actually, introductions first. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
Bobby Padovich.
Charles Andrews.
Now, what the hell are you talking about?
Our guests here, Bobby and Charles from DC, legendary DC band, Night Streets.
Night Streets.
Here's the thing about Rush. This is what I've always heard about the band, and I want to see what you guys think about this, that it is a guy band. That women do not like Rush. Have you found this to be true?
This is not true.
Not true, okay.
Not true. I know plenty of women who love Rush.
Okay.
At the same time...
Can I have their number?
And yet, if you go to a Rush show, the line for the guy's bathroom is a lot. There is a line, and there's not one for the women's bathroom. It is true.
Maybe the numbers are skewed a little bit in favor of male
but
fans.
I wonder why this is. And it, not only has this sort of been the reputation of the band, but there was a movie out several years ago called I Love You, Man. Do you remember this movie with Jason Segel and Paul Rudd? Anybody see this movie?
I remember this movie.
I never saw it, but I know there is a lot of there's some Rush elements to it, and yes. I know those guys are big Rush fans.
Yes.
I believe they have a cameo in it. Do they have a cameo in it? I think they at the end.
I think they do, but Rush's music plays a role in the movie throughout, and it's sort of a bromance kind of movie.
Right.
It's called I Love You, Man. And the fact that they chose Rush songs to sort of like be the soundtrack of the movie was on purpose because of that, because it was like this bonding sort of music for these two guys, right? These two adult men, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just wonder what you guys thought about the whole idea of it being sort of a, you know, having this male centric fan base. But what you're saying is that may not be totally accurate, right?
Well, I think the fan base has changed over time. I think they're so huge now that you're seeing families going, you know, my daughter loves Rush.
Really?
Oh yeah.
That's very cool.
I guess
she did like a couple of years ago when I took her to a Rush concert, and now.
Well, I think like you touched on it. There's the broader sort of thing that's happened is we've discussed a little bit this week. To be a Rush fan in high school or whatever, you know, it was nerdy. I remember personally, like, you know, if you're going to be a devoted Rush fan in high school, you're just going to accept that you're going to catch a little heat for it. You're going to be a little nerdy for it. But a curious thing has happened where, you know, the nerds are now in positions of power.
Right.
And so you see these things happening where, you know, the people, that stigma gets shaken a little bit. People discover them. They're like, wow, these guys kick ass. The fan base broadens. They go on. You know, I remember that Rush made an appearance on Colbert Report when he was back on Comedy Central. It was like one of their only U.S. appearances, and they talked a little bit about it too. They have hit this period of sort of like rebirth a little bit and broader discovery where the fan base is broadening out. And I think that's the more of the complete look at it. I guess I just took that for granted. Like historically, it was just like a dude's band.
Yeah.
Yeah. And part of it to me, and they may have written about this at one point in their career in a certain song, but they were working guys, man. You know, they went out on the road. People related to them in that sense. You know, guys that were construction workers and blue collar workers really related to Rush because they did what they were doing. They got up and they went to work every day and they played, right? And they never let you down, right?
You go to work at a factory all day. You want to come home, listen to some dudes
in
kimonos.
Yeah, you do. And that's right.
And you want to identify with.
Turn it up really loud on the way home. But yeah,
you make a good point. They seemed relatable in some way that maybe other rock stars didn't, right?
Yeah, they weren't detached. They weren't doing anything they wouldn't have asked anyone else to do, right? They were out there working hard. You got the sense they might have carried their own gear if they had to, you know, and set it up, right?
And also, I think the fact that they didn't have a golden god sort of front man.
Yeah, right. Right.
What are you talking about, man? Getty, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they also weren't writing, ballads to get laid.
Hell no. Know?
That's true. They were writing about...
They didn't have the power ballad thing, right?
Well, they were reading like 14 books a week. They didn't have time to get laid. They'd finish this book.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, they were what they were, and that embodied a lot of the feelings of, you know, I guess guys who would have those similar feelings of like alienation or not being able to relate or not being super popular or things like that. And definitely one of the songs we'll talk about today from the album Signals. Is maybe, all about that.
Maybe this is why I couldn't relate to the band early, because I was so popular.
Well, yeah.
I had the same problem.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So the album we're going to talk about today is Signals, 1982. Yeah. And I remember this very well. This came out in my popular high school days. Is there a certain song we want to kick off with here?
I mean, I think you got to go with Subdivisions for a number of reasons, right? But it's the one that wraps up the whole Suburbs thing.
What we're talking about right now.
You know? But I want to focus on the end of the song, which is just Rush as a band just killing it. Like, they come out of the solo and hit sort of like going toward the end of the song. Neil also has some real awesome lyrics going on there that Getty's wailing on. For me, it's one of my favorite, like, moments of Rush.
Be cool or be cast out.
Goosebumps every time.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Through millions of listens, I still get goosebumps at that.
Yeah, they're communicating on some very deep levels at all times.
Yeah. And I love that one too, because it's like we said, it's just got such iconic lyrics going on there that sort of encapsulate the Rush themes. But then under the surface, it's just like they're just kicking so much butt, like, as a rock song. It's unbelievable. They're wailing out of the solo, and then as a real in the weeds drummer reference, the beat that Neil's playing there from the ride cymbal and the China, that's one of his kind of signature beats that I would say he invented, you know, and he's really famous for that. So just that's one of the reasons why Subdivisions, one of the many reasons why I like that song as a Rush song, is one of the most, you know, amazing.
As a drummer, do you play along to a lot of their tracks? Is that something that, you know, sort of help you develop?
It was something that from my first days as a drummer that I tried to do, you know, growing up, trying to play along to Rush songs, definitely. And I guess, like, for me, there's a few that I still love to play, and there's others that... a lot of the stuff, like, most drummers just don't have the drums to replicate it, you know?
Right.
But and he's an amazing example of a drummer who uses every piece of his drum kit, which is enormous, but he uses every single piece of it in many different ways, and that's just super incredible.
And what about you, Charles? Is there things that Getty Lee does that influence you?
Oh, I think just the way he, you know, he plays a lot that's very under the radar. Like, you don't, you know, while he's singing, and he's, you know, playing a keyboard line with his foot. He just does these little fills and things that I've noticed them more when I've tried to sort of pick apart what he's playing, and then I discovered he's doing so much all the time, but you don't always hear it until if you listen to the bass part and then you realize just how much is going on there. One thing, listening to this song, like this album, you know, they used synthesizers on previous albums, but mm-hmm. this is the album where the synthesizer is suddenly a star.
Yeah.
And like right. before it becomes like a reckless taking over the band star in later albums, it's still like, it's a very welcome addition here.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, it just dominates that whole song there.
Oh, totally. Yeah. There's a certain new waviness to this album, right? Yeah.
For sure, but it still has the organic, like the real organic backbone.
Right.
And that's why for me, it's the bridge album. It's kind of the perfect bridge album before things. I mean, I have a soft spot in my heart for all of the 80s Rush, but things definitely got pretty synthesizer-y there.
Got a little out of hand there
in some later albums. Signals is... and especially a song like Subdivisions is where it all comes together.
Why do you guys think the synthesizers got out of hand?
Yeah.
That's an excellent question. I mean, how can you explain the late 80s? how do you tell your kids about the late 80s?
But, well, it's funny, you know, and we've referenced like some of the documentaries and stuff that have been made on Rush, and they talk about this a lot, and like they had, I guess, like their version of the band fights about this, which as like three best friends from Canada
right.
were like, that's about as dramatic as it got. Right. It was just like, all right.
It was an actual debate.
Yeah. Alex didn't really want to do it, but like he was cool about it. And he said, all right. And like they made their albums that were dripping with synthesizers and everything. But I think it is a good question to think about, like why... they never really talk about like the root, you know, of why they went in that direction. I don't know. Like it.
Yeah, they seem a little apologetic about that. It's hard for me
to figure out in retrospect, certainly. But yeah.
Yeah, but what's neat about their use of the synthesizer here, I think there's a lot of bands that as the tides changed in musical taste, you know, a producer or a record company might pressure a band to start, you know, putting some synth in or let's get a dance hit here. And with Rush, at least through Signals, you get the impression that when they included something new, like the reggae beat in Spirit of the Radio or, you know, the synths on this album, it's because they really wanted
to. They just wanted to experiment with it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Or they were into it at the time and they wanted to apply it. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It seemed real.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it never seemed forced.
And I think it's really well done on Signals.
Oh, yeah.
Like, to me, it's not overdone here at all.
Mm-hmm.
But, and also, I think... you know, if you compare them to prog rock bands of like, say, the late 70s, early 80s, like a band like Yes, mm-hmm. I don't think they did as much with synthesizers and keyboards as like Yes did.
No.
Well, Yes was doing stuff with like modular key synthesizers. They were really nerding out about it. I mean, this was like popular synth.
Right.
It sounds cool. This reminds me a little bit of the Van Halen album 1984.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, where the synth, I mean, ordinarily you would think, I want to hear Eddie Van Halen, not a synthesizer, but it's awesome.
It's woven in a way that's true to the, it's just still the band.
It's in service to the song. Yeah. It's not just to like show off on, new technology.
Yeah. And part of that has to be, not to go too far down a rabbit hole, but part of that has to be artistic burnout and artistic yearning for something different, right? You've been playing guitar and trying to write new riffs on guitar for, 20 years. And that's very refreshing as an artist to have a new tool. And so you can understand it. Yeah. We're Russ apologists now. So we just apologize. Basically, for later. We figured it out. It's okay. We forgive you.
But there's also the second song on the album, which I wanted to mention, The Analog Kid, is just, I think it's another great example of a song that just rocks. Like they mix it in there a little bit, but out of the gate, it just rocks.
Absolutely. And then when the synth does come in and the little break or chorus, I don't know what to call it. I guess it's a chorusy thing. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah. It's a cool welcome. Like it's a totally like breath of fresh air. Yeah. We'll be right back.
You know, while at the same time that they're using the synths and moving forward with their sound, I feel like one of the things that makes this album great, and that track especially, is that, you know, Geddy, you hear his bass, he's playing the old Rickenbacker. You know, I mean, he plays that throughout his career, but I know in Moving Pictures he was playing a Fender a little more, but, you know, the Rickenbacker and the settings they have on it sounds a little more like something off Fly By Night. So
yeah.
At the same time they're moving forward, they're moving backwards.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Interesting.
It all comes together. But I do think it with Rush, it has to be noted, and there's an example on this album of they did some pretty cheesy things, you know,
maybe
throughout the course of their career. And like even any big fan would admit to that. So like on this album, the song Countdown, for example.
I know a Rush fan. I know a Rush fan, and that is his favorite song.
Really?
And you will always have
absolute favorite
that.
Song. You love it. Not me.
Yeah. And the classic example is the rap on Roll the Bones, right? Where it's been made fun of constantly.
But even they make fun of it.
Yeah, exactly. But it's definitely an aspect of their music. Like they're... It, you know, it must be admitted there's a couple misses, a couple clunkers, and a couple like cringeworthy moments in the Rush catalog.
So around this time, you're too young for this, Bobby. The other guys here might understand what I'm about to say.
I'll just sit back.
But speaking of cheesy, but it works. Around this time, Geddy Lee did a collaboration with Bob and Doug McKenzie.
Yes.
Right. Right. Did.
I'm so glad you mentioned that's actually one of my favorite things. That
take off to the Great White
that's
North.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
Oh, beauty, go. Okay. Good day. Welcome to our single. I'm Bob McKenzie, and this is my brother Doug. How's it going, eh? Beauty, eh?
Yeah, I like that.
Okay.
Okay, everyone, this record was my idea.
Get out!
It was.
You're lying.
Hosehead here just sort of rid on my coattails.
Why are you doing this? It was our idea together, eh?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay.
We agreed to say that, but...
Oh, take off!
Insane, eh?
Yeah,
he's good.
And that endeared him, I think, to millions of like geeky high school kids, right?
Hardworking beer drinking men too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was great thing about it. It was like, yeah, they were nerds. Yeah. They didn't care. It's amazing. We're nerds. Sure. Mm-hmm.
They owned it.
Mm-hmm. Another iconic album cover. You never forget this one when
the
you
Dalmatian
see it.
The Dalmatian with the fire hydrant?
Yeah, because it's like on artificial turf. What's that about? And it doesn't take up the whole cover. It's just in the middle. I've never understood it. I've stared at it for many hours in the record store when there was nobody in the record store going, why did they? I don't understand.
I was going to ask, you didn't bring any vinyl over today.
No, I did
not. Do you have much Rush
vinyl? I do. Actually, I have Moving Pictures, and I have the set I was mentioning, Archives, which I think is a triple record of the first three.
Okay.
It's got Fly By Night and Crest of Steel and...
the first one or 2112?
No, 2112. I can't remember. Okay. There's three in there. And then I do not have this on vinyl, but I do have it on a compact disc some reason.
Yeah. Well.
Uh-huh. So I'm a classicist. Yeah.
I think the dust jacket of this album has one of the finest portraits of Rush. Circa 1982.
Yes. I'm remembering it now.
The big glasses.
Very small.
The blazers started to creep in a little bit.
There might have been some shoulder pads happening.
Oh, there was definitely shoulder pads.
Yeah. I have to think that when CDs came out that like Rush would have been one of those bands that you would have to get on CD like right away.
Yeah.
Right. Like it just it felt like that kind of experience you had to have. Mm-hmm. Like I gotta hear this on crisp, clear digital laser technology, right?
It's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now you got to go back and get it on vinyl.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just clarifying here, it is, it's the first album, Fly By Night and Crest of Steel.
There you go.
So I actually have the first album. I'll go back and listen to it.
It's a great album.
It's a heavy blues rock Led Zeppelin album by a different
band.
It's
killer.
I've learned this tonight. Yeah. I will play it when I get home.
Totally worth it, especially on vinyl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do any of you guys have any weed on you?
No comment.
We're not in D.C. proper, so no.
Never mind. I'm just having a t-shirt delivered. Right. It's $125. Thank you.
That's a topic for another podcast.
Yeah, that's total. Okay. Let's cut that out.
All right. Well, this has been good.
Yeah,
these studio albums. Tomorrow we're going to talk about live music, right?
I can't wait.
Got to
move on to that.
Got to save a whole, you know, and there's not just one album there. It's just Rush live.
Hollow Axe.
Well, I think, Bobby, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this is the first album with a guest artist on it. I believe Jean-Luc Ponty plays violin on track 7.
Oh, yeah. Is that right?
That's right. And it was a big deal on their final tour, what became their final tour, that he came back and played live on a few shows on Losing It.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
It was Losing It, right?
It was on Losing It, yeah.
Yeah. Is that what you want to hear to play out or something else?
That's a good one.
All right, let's do that. We're going to bypass all the closing business, I think, right now, because we want to get right into tomorrow's
episode. We want to get right into Losing It.
Yes, right. All right, so, Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
Bobby Padovic.
Charles Andrews.
We'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
Dancers, flows of frantic pace and pain and desperation. Her aching limbs and downcast face aglow with perspiration. Stiff as wire, her lungs on fire with just the briefest pause. Flooding through her memory, echoes of old applause. And she limps across the floor and closes her bedroom door. Stares with glassy eyes, defies the empty page. It is white, his face is lined and streaked with tears of rage. 30 years ago, how the words would flow with passion and precision. Now his mind is darkened all by sickness and indecision. And he stares out the kitchen door, where the sun will rise no more.
Sid and I have gotten pretty good at a couple of Rush songs.
What do you mean, like fast-paced rock?
No, like Rush. Like the band Rush.
I don't know them.
The Holy Triumvirate. Wait, you don't know Rush?
No.
You don't know Rush, the band?
No, mm-mm.
Exit the Warrior, Today's Tom Sawyer?
No.
All right, I'm going to hit you up with a little iTunes action. Hey, let me ask you something. Are you ready to get your world rocked?
Ready! Yes.
Are you ready to get your mind blown?
Do it!
You want to get some Neil Peart all up in you?
I don't know.
Well, prepare to be Rushified! Sounds better on big speakers.
I could see that.